Boyd. Up next on Think, whether you're on it or not, Instagram has changed the way we look at pretty much everything. We'll spend this hour with journalist Sarah Friar, who covers the social media industry for Bloomberg and is just out with a book tracing the history of the photo sharing app that launched the era of the artful selfie and the influencer. We'll find out why Instagram became the place to share pictures among a crowded field of competitors, about its founders' insistence on aesthetics as a core value, and how that created friction between Instagram and parent company Facebook. Our conversation starts after a short break. Look like before we staged everything for Instagram? Well, nobody's life actually looks like Instagram, at least not all the time. But in just 10 years since the platform's launch, it has had an enormous influence on our sense of who and what is beautiful, interesting, and worthy of imitation. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We go to Instagram to experience aesthetically pleasing images, carefully curated by tastemakers and regular users alike, aspiring toward perfection. But beneath that placid veneer, at the company itself, especially since it was bought up by Facebook for $1 billion in 2012, there's been more tension than many of us might imagine. Creative differences, disenchantment among original employees who did not strike it rich when Mark Zuckerberg came calling, and disputes over just how independent Instagram should remain from its parent company. Journalist Sarah Friar covers social media companies for Bloomberg News, and she's put her extensive research into a new book called No Filter: The Inside Story of Instagram. Sarah, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start by talking about how Instagram really has shaped the way we take pictures, the way we view pictures. What are some of the things we do now with Instagram in mind that we maybe didn't do a decade ago?
Well, it's something that you can, if you start to look for it, you can see it in every restaurant, in every coffee shop, in every vacation, in every wedding, all these little things that people have done to make life more visually interesting. And it's not just about how we design our spaces, it's about how we decide to use our time. Especially young people have decided to spend their money more on experiences than things. They're more likely to pay to go on a vacation than pay for a new car. And that's completely transformed our economy and the way that people think about selling things to us and designing new products. And it's also really changed the way we perceive what an interesting person is. Mm. We can look at someone's Instagram account and see their version of how they want the world to perceive them. And everyone has become a curator in some ways of their personal brand. We have more awareness now of what it means to succeed in a personal image, which is not something that was, if you can imagine 10 years ago, that was not something that was very widely done.
And there are even chefs who create dishes designed mostly just to look cool on Instagram.
I mean, sometimes it matters more what it looks like than what it tastes like. People will pay a premium for something with like a little gold flake on it or a latte with a nice heart shape in the foam. And you know, we've seen trends happen all around the country, whether it's the cronut or the rainbow bagel. You've heard of all these things. People are making cakes where when you cut them, candy spills out of the center. people are getting all of those Mylar balloons for their birthday parties and baby showers that look great in a photo, but what are you going to do with that balloon really? And so it's really transformed the way we think about celebrating and the way we think about making something a worthwhile experience.
All right. I want to talk about Kevin. Is it pronounced Systrom, the co-founder of Instagram?
Systrom.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He was at Stanford around the same time as Mark Zuckerberg. When did they first meet?
Well, so Mark Zuckerberg was in Palo Alto at the time because he had just dropped out of Harvard, and Kevin was at Stanford. The two are right next to each other, like about a bordering towns, really. And they met at a fraternity party for one of Kevin's fraternities, and they were sipping beers, and Zuckerberg was very awkward at the party, and but he really needed engineers to work on this new project he had going called the Facebook.com. And this is the thing that he had quit Harvard to try to build. And this is 2005, so these guys are all very young. They're all in their early 20s, if that. And he asks Kevin Systrom to meet with him because he's seen this app that this website, I should say, there were no apps yet. This website that he built for Stanford students to share their photos online. And Zuckerberg said, "Oh, well, we probably need some photo stuff for the Facebook site," because at that time it was all text. So he asked if Kevin will come build it for him. And Kevin has a mentor tell him, "I don't really know about this Facebook thing. I don't think it's really going to go anywhere." And Kevin agrees. And it's more important to him that he get a good education and graduate. He didn't come to Silicon Valley for a sort of get rich quick startup glory story, though he ended up having one. But he turned Zuckerberg down. And later, he ends up working in a downtown Palo Alto cafe, makes some extra money. Zuckerberg comes in and orders a coffee and is just like, "What are you doing? Like, you could have had everything."
Well,
But that's how he valued.
Systrom had some tech skills, but that really wasn't where his passions lay, right? Like, what was he interested in?
So after he turns down Zuckerberg, he goes on a study abroad program in Florence, and that really opens his eyes up to this kind of crafted sense of, what is good, like the stitching of Italian leather, the making of wine, and especially photography. He really gets into photography. He brings this high-end camera, the best one he could afford at the time, and his professor in Florence tells him, "Give me that. You're not going to shoot with that. You're going to shoot with this tiny plastic Holga camera that takes blurry, light leaking photos, and you're going to learn what really the fundamentals of photography are, that it's not about the technical specs of the photo. It's about the composition. It's about the mood that you feel when you see a photo." So he really gets into the art of that. And when he comes back to Silicon Valley and he works at Google, he interns at Odeo. He's immersed in this hacker culture where people just want to make a better version of these products by solving really interesting technical problems. But he just has a different way of looking at the world. Like, he's more well-rounded. He does not consider himself to be like a hacker type of optimization person. He's more interested in, like, are these products solving problems for people? What are interesting ways of thinking about how to solve that problem? And eventually he gets the inspiration to try his hand at making an app, even though he's not really an engineer.
It was the thing he called bourbon. What exactly did bourbon do?
Well, Bourbon was a mobile app that was built on the mobile web. It was very clunky. It was not the sort of perfect, refined thing that you think of Instagram as. In fact, it had all the aspects of what people were excited about on mobile, which was location-based check-ins and meetup tools. And yes, there was photo adding, but it was kind of like a website on a phone. And people were using it. They were liking it. People were really excited that with the rise of smartphones, you could bring the phone with you wherever you went and make it a part of your experience. So it was kind of that idea. But even though it was catching on, he didn't know that it would have wide relevance. And he was able to raise some money for it, which in Silicon Valley means now you got a company. But when he hired his co-founder, Mike Krieger, he had to confess, "I don't think that I'm working on the right thing. I think we need to completely scrap this." And so they went to a whiteboard and They sorted through all of the different features of the product they were making. And then they asked that same question: what problem are we trying to solve? Are we trying to make a fancy camera, or are we trying to make a good picture? You know, that kind of concept that applied to this product. And they decided that, you know, let's just keep it simple. Let's just do one thing really, really well. And they picked photos, and they because they thought that eventually, as everyone has phones in their pockets over time, as smartphones become more of a part of our lives, everyone's going to need a place to put nice photos. And then Kevin went on vacation, and his wife told him that, or sorry, now wife, at the time it was just his girlfriend, told him that she would probably never use that app because all the photos she takes on her phone are bad. And that's when Kevin decided to think about adding filters and making it so that the same photo development techniques that he learned in Florence could be applied digitally.
Yeah, they made a number of early decisions at that point about the filters, about sharing and following that would become important in the long run. Why did Krieger and Systrom decide not to allow users to share another contributor's photos?
They thought that if they were going to appeal to artists and creatives, that type of person doesn't really like their work to be shared. They would prefer to build up their own portfolio and reputation. So it was really thought of in that sense. Like if you go to someone's page, you should see what they created, not what someone else created. And this had really important effects for Instagram's power in our lives. Because it's a simple thing that they decided not to do. It seems so obvious to everyone else because Twitter has viral sharing, Facebook has viral sharing, and it's really the way that products grew. Social products have always grown by content going viral and getting more attention. That's how you raise the number of comments and likes and shares, and that's how people gain followings if their content gets discovered. But on Instagram, because they decided that people would only be able to post their own stuff, it became not about the content, it became about the person. And so if content wasn't going viral, people were getting famous. And that was tremendously important for understanding why Instagram became such an important personal branding tool. Why that's the place where if you go to someone's Instagram, you see a reflection of what they have created and what they want you to think about them.
You mentioned a couple of minutes ago the early capital that they raised to make their company. Some of that money came from Jack Dorsey, and people may know that name because he invented Twitter. What was their relationship with him beyond financial? What did he do for the company besides give it money in the beginning?
Well, I think Jack Dorsey was the first Instagram influencer, if you can think about it that way. He was such a big fan of the product. I'll take a step back. He knew Kevin Systrom from Kevin interning at Odeo around the same time that Jack Dorsey started. Now, Odeo, if you know your Silicon Valley history, was the company that later transformed into Twitter. And Jack was the inventor of Twitter, but that was after Kevin had already left. So they had stayed in contact, they'd stayed friends, but Kevin didn't go work at Twitter either. And Jack actually was having a terrible conflict with his co-founder, Ev Williams, and was kicked out of the company. And so when Kevin goes to him and says, "Would you like to invest?" then he's very flattered and he starts sharing Instagram everywhere he can.
My guest is Sarah Friar. She reports on social media companies for Bloomberg News. Her new book is called No Filter: The Inside Story of Instagram. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Sarah Friar, who covers social media companies for Bloomberg News and has a new book out called No Filter: The Inside Story of Instagram. Another important choice, as you mentioned, Sarah, is that in the beginning, Krieger and Systrom didn't necessarily want the largest possible number of users. They were going for quality over quantity. So what kinds of users did they actively recruit in the beginning?
They were interested in appealing to people who would create interesting things on Instagram. And that held true for the rest of the company's life. In the very beginning, it was about photographers and musicians, and of course, people in the tech industry who had large followings on Twitter. And the way that Instagram worked back then is if you posted a photo, you could share that photo to your other social networks. So it could just enhance whatever you were posting on Twitter or Facebook or Foursquare or Tumblr. And when people who were these influential creatives were posting their Instagram enhanced photos on their other networks, the probably most prominent among them was Mr. Jack Dorsey, who had them among the most followers on Twitter. They drew interest in this app. People asked, how did you get your photo to be so beautiful? And how did you do this? And then they redirected everyone to Instagram. Hmm. And so it was really, it was like an early campaign. And that really set the tone for what Instagram was about. It was like about looking at your world in a more beautiful way, about finding the artsy shot or the shot that will portray things in a little bit of a different angle and turn everyone into a photographer.
All of that is still true, but of course we now associate Instagram with celebrities, all-purpose celebrities and site-made celebrities. Who were the first people who were famous outside of Instagram to understand what the site could do for them?
Well, there was this guy named Cole Rise. He was a local photographer and artist in San Francisco, and he saw that of all of the apps with filters that he had used, and there were a few of them at the time, Instagrams were the most like the actual art that he created. And that had, he had thanks for Kevin Systrom for having that photography background, that when he created photo filters, they actually looked professional. And so he reached out to the guys and said, you know, this is going to be huge. Like, I don't know what you guys, if you guys realize this, but what you've done is just unlike anything I've seen. And so then they went and got a drink together and asked this photographer if he would create more filters for Instagram. So we did. And eventually this art that he was doing, like creating filters for photos, became so used in mass, and he became famous on Instagram, and his career sort of changes from this art gallery style of working to like just having an Instagram presence. And it's really interesting for him because on one hand, his art is now everywhere. His filters that he made for Instagram, like used the corkboard in his kitchen as texturing. Like for him, it was very surreal, but also like he kind of just gave it away, the secret of his art.
It's fascinating that Instagram's profile was rising so rapidly, and yet there was just a handful of employees a couple years in. How did Mark Zuckerberg make his move to acquire ownership of the company, and why was he willing to pay so much for it?
Mark Zuckerberg understands something called like network effect, which means that if we see a critical mass of people we know or people we're interested in on one network, the likelihood that we join a competitor is very low. And it's just likely that this network will grow exponentially. And the way Zuckerberg thinks is very much, he has this paranoia around Facebook's longevity. He wants Facebook to gain ground, to be more dominant. And he knows that they have a weakness because Facebook has not been built well on mobile phones. And Instagram is the most mobile native app you can imagine. And so he hears that Instagram has has turned down Twitter and is raising more money to remain independent. And he calls right away and says that Kevin should come do a deal. And Kevin Systrom wasn't trying to sell Instagram at the time, though he had a lot of interest, including from Twitter. He answered this appeal from Zuckerberg by hearing him out. Like, he was told by one of his investors, if the king of the internet is giving you a call to meet, you better meet. So he does. And over a whirlwind weekend at Mark Zuckerberg's Palo Alto home, Zuckerberg says the one thing that really resonates with Kevin Systrom, which is, if we acquire you at Facebook, not only will we pay you $1 billion, yes, the money is important, but it's not everything. The ego is the more important thing. And if you join us, we will keep you independent. You will remain the founder with all of the vision over the future of Instagram and all of the resources of Facebook and so much less risk. And you will have the chance to build your product into something really big and powerful, and you have more likelihood of doing that at Facebook than you do on your own.
Did Zuckerberg
and that worked.
Did Zuckerberg know a lot of that was a lie when he said it?
I don't think either of them knew what was going to happen. Facebook had never made an acquisition that didn't result in the entire product being absorbed into the main Facebook product. Kevin believed him that he would keep it independent, but he faced a lot of doubt from his investors that Zuckerberg was telling the truth. And I don't think Zuckerberg knew what independence meant or how he was actually going to organize it. He just knew that this is the way to win the deal. And he knew that because he turned down a deal to sell Facebook to Yahoo in 2006 for $1 billion. He was really on the edge of making that decision, but then he just couldn't do it. He couldn't bring himself to do it because he wanted to build Facebook into a bigger thing. He wanted it to succeed in a way beyond what he thought it would be if Yahoo kept their priorities around it.
So I can't stress enough, the company was still just a couple of years old. There were still just a handful of employees. Krieger and Systrom, as co-founders, split that $1 billion. What happened to everybody else who was working for them?
There's a lot of hard feelings because a lot of people didn't get payouts. It was more painful because every new site is just completely excited and shocked by this $1 billion deal, that a lot of them are running headlines that said, oh, look, meet the new millionaires. Here are the 13 employees who work for Instagram. And now they have made an average of $77 million each from the deal. They all had different calculations for how rich everyone was. And people's parents were calling them and their friends were calling them and saying, what are you going to do with all your riches? Everyone was assuming that they were rich. And then a couple weeks after the announcement, first they hear that they're not sure if the deal is going to go through because regulators have to look at it first. And then they hear that, yes, they will keep their jobs, but they're just getting a little raise and a bonus if they stay at Facebook for a year. I mean, certainly a couple of the very earliest employees did make serious wealth off the acquisition, but a lot of them did not and are still bitter about it because they think, like, if Instagram had distributed that wealth, if Kevin and Mike had distributed that wealth more among employees, they could have gone on to start their own companies, or they could have gone on to invest in other things. And you could see that happen in Silicon Valley over and over, that the early employees of a company end up feeding the next great innovation. And they're still paying rent on apartments in some cases. So it didn't work out.
Why not tip those folks out, if you'll pardon the crudeness of the expression, $1 million or $2 a piece? Would that still have not satisfied people, or would it have allowed people to feel like they had been treated fairly?
Oh, I think that they certainly would have felt better in that case. I think the logic was, look, they only had a certain amount of money in the pool from the deal to distribute to employees. They wanted to give the earliest ones huge rewards. And because this company was so young, 18 months at the time of the deal, a lot of people had only worked there, you know, 3 to 6 months. Most of the staff had only worked there 3 to 6 months. They're like, well, why do you need life-changing wealth after only working somewhere for that short amount of time? But the answer to that is, that's why you take the risk on a startup. That's why you decide to join Instagram instead of joining Google at the very early days, because it's uncertain, it's high risk, but it's also high reward. And so they just didn't get that reward.
One of the things, and this really speaks to his personality, one of the things Systrom did insist on keeping control of was the physical look, the design of the offices out of which Instagram operated. And there are some really interesting stories about that. So what did he want it to look like in their offices?
Well, the offices are, so a little later on, fast forward a couple years, Instagram is part of Facebook. And Facebook has this very distinctive way of organizing their offices. One of their biggest mottos is, our journey is only 1% finished. So it's unfinished wood, open ceilings where you can see all of the piping and air vents. You have a lot of posters everywhere that say done is better than perfect, and move fast and break things. And Instagram was all about like the creative community and curation and having this sense of craft and the finished product. And so it was very grating on Kevin, especially since they did so much work trying to appeal to celebrities. At one point, he even like ripped down some of the posters in the office. And they end up moving into an office of their own. Once they've made enough revenue, they end up moving into an office of their own. And it is full of these Instagrammable pockets. Like there's this difference of in the Instagram office, you have like this cloud display, these puffy plastic clouds. And you could like be in this photo booth and take pictures with the clouds. There's also one that like seems like you're in space. The funniest story about the difference between Facebook and Instagram is at one point, Kevin Systrom got very upset about the trash cans that were under everyone's desks. And one day employees came to the office and they're just all gone. And everyone's like, what is happening? He says, well, this is not us. I mean, we have a polished way of thinking. We are not going to sit with trash underneath our desks. And employees were very upset because they wanted to be able to work and throw away their trash at their feet instead of getting up to throw it away. And Systrom was widely ridiculed. They used the hashtag trash can gate. They called it Benghazi in a nod to the Benghazi scandal. It was just so important to him that if people came to the office, if the Kardashians came to the office, or if, you know, the teens that they were pulling came to the office, that they would come in and say, oh, this is Instagram. And now if you go there, the photos are framed, the trash is hidden in these wooden paneled, nice cabinets. I mean, it's just, it reflects what he wants for the app.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. How did Systrom try to manage the presence of ads on his site when he began to allow them?
He was very particular. He wanted it to be like the pages of Vogue. He wanted the ads to reflect products as if they were part of some aspirational lifestyle. Very similar to what you see in influencer posting. Like this ad just feels like it fits into your feed. And so every day there would only be one ad that would run. This is like the end of 2013, early 2014. They're first starting this. So like Ben & Jerry's one day, Michael Kors the next day, Lexus the next day. And he was so so interested in the quality of these ads that his business assistant would have to print out all of them one by one, and he would go through and approve them. And sometimes he would disapprove. There was one ad in particular that he actually edited while on a plane to increase the crispiness of the French fries in the picture. And you know, he's like, oh, don't worry, it just needs like a little bit of an adjustment here and there, so some fixing to the saturation. And okay, fine, now the ad is ready to run. But this is what the CEO of a platform used by hundreds of millions of people was doing on his plane flight. So it's very interesting what he chose to spend his time on.
That doesn't sound like done is better than perfect.
No, the very opposite of Facebook. And actually, in just a few months from then, Zuckerberg says, listen, like, this is not going to work for me. You have so much potential. Like, we've seen the advertiser interest. I want you to get Instagram to $1 billion in revenue by 2015. And if you are not going to do it yourself, Facebook's going to do it for you. And that lit a fire under the team. One of the executives who was working there at the time compared it to being put in a microwave. Like, your business will get hotter faster, but it might explode. Like, everything that Instagram has valued and worked on and done with their branding was threatened in that moment because Facebook ads looked like billboards. They looked like not Instagram-y at all. But eventually they found a compromise and it worked out. They did get to their billion in revenue.
My guest is Sarah Friar, who reports on social media companies for Bloomberg News. Her new book is called No Filter: The Inside Story of Instagram. We'll be right back. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest, Sarah Friar, reports on social media companies for Bloomberg News, and she's just out with a new book called No Filter: The Inside Story of Instagram. All right, Sarah, the time has come to talk about the rise of the influencer. You dropped the K word the other day, segment, Kardashian. So what had the Kardashians learned about becoming famous from Paris Hilton that they applied to their lives on Instagram?
The Kardashians were not traditional A-list celebrities who were really worried about revealing too much of their lives to the public. They were trained in the art of reality television from Paris Hilton. Paris Hilton became friends with Kim Kardashian early on, back before Instagram even began. And the Kardashians saw how Paris curated the public's perception of her, not just on her show, The Simple Life, but in everything she did, in the you know, walks that she would go out to restaurants, someone would tip the paparazzi, and then the paparazzi would take, they would even see the paparazzi with people that were friendly enough to take a good photo. They had an interesting thing going on with manipulating the media and then also branding Paris Hilton as more than just a show, but an overall lifestyle. Like the her manager told me, like Barbie if she were real. And what the Kardashians drew from that is you can actually create more affinity for your products and your brand if you show a little bit more of your life and you develop this relationship, because people are more likely to buy things from their friends than they are from a stranger. And it's like if you get a restaurant recommendation, you might not believe the Yelp review as much as you believe your friend who tells you to try out a new thing. And so they figured that if they started using social media, it might be good for them in that way. Now, what they did that Paris Hilton did not is they realized that you could take money from brands and you could post photos about these products, and the money would come not from selling the photo, but from selling the products using the photo, if that makes sense. So whereas Paris Hilton was in the business of selling her image, the Kardashians realized if you give the image away for free, then you can do branding and merchandising on top of that.
Did
It was
Instagram
really innovative. I talked with Kris Jenner. She told me that a lot of A-list celebrities were very, very concerned and confused about why you would even invest so much in Instagram, because they thought, as famous people, if you were to show so much of your life, wouldn't that take away the mystery? Wouldn't that take away the famousness, the aura around these people? And especially actors were thinking, like, if I show who I am in my day-to-day life, will it be hard for people to imagine me in character? So it was definitely a flip on how people thought about entertainment media and building a brand.
So if somebody was paying a celebrity to use or show their product on Instagram in a photograph, did Instagram get any money off that? Were they deriving revenue from influencers?
No, and in fact, they swore themselves against it, and they were in denial for a long time that their help for certain people and not others was in any way economically beneficial to the people they were helping. But of course it was. I mean, they didn't want Instagram to become too commercialized. They wanted it to stay a place for art, and they already had to start putting ads there. And that was really something that they thought would maybe ruin it. But of course, as people gained followings on Instagram, and as Instagram became, like I mentioned earlier, the place to reflect who you are more wholly, the personal brand, they had to admit that they had this power over people's careers, and they didn't want to tip the scales any further beyond that. And they didn't want to be the people deciding so explicitly who would get paid and who wouldn't.
Instagram did not invent stories, which are these entries that live on the app for like 24 hours before being deleted automatically. That was the brainchild of Snapchat. Why was Kevin Systrom so opposed to the idea of something like stories when so many of his staffers were pushing for it early on?
He really thought that Instagram was the place for the most beautiful photo. It was the place for the curated version of your life. Unfortunately, that's not great for usage, because if people feel so much pressure to post on Instagram, they're not going to post as often. They're maybe going to post only when something really exciting happens in their life. And Kevin Systrom, of course, he was meeting all of these fantastic celebrities around the world. He was meeting world leaders. He was always traveling. He had plenty of great things to post on his Instagram, but most of us don't. And most of us were really intimidated by the way that the app had become so, so perfect. And eventually, when he went to the Oscars, he saw that even celebrities were having the same problem, where they would post one photo on Instagram, but on Snapchat, they would post the photo of getting ready, the photo in the limo on the way to the red carpet, some scenes from the red carpet, and people wanted that content. And he realized that Instagram was leaving stuff on the cutting room floor. So he quickly admitted he was wrong and figured out a way to do stories that was not a direct copycat of Snapchat, but a little bit different, with the little heads, the bubble heads at the top of the Instagram app. If you're an Instagram user, you know what I mean. He quickly was able to turn it around and actually ended up accelerating the growth of Instagram. All of the concerns about whether people would still use the product because of too much pressure were somewhat alleviated. I would say there's still plenty of pressure on Instagram, but at least for that release valve, there was now a way to post something more raw.
Facebook has a stories feature now too, but it doesn't, and most of my friends are like middle-aged, but it doesn't seem to get the same kind of traction that stories do on Instagram.
It does, depending on what country you're in, but yeah, they've released it after Instagram, and it's not like people are posting everyday moments on Facebook as often, because the way these networks are designed is very different. Instagram is a place where you may be following strangers or maybe followed by strangers. Facebook is a place where all of your friend connections are mutual, and people's friend groups have really ballooned over the years. I don't know about you, but I have friends on my Facebook that I haven't talked to in maybe a decade. And so I think it's just a different purpose for those stories. And And that sparked a lot of jealousy from Mark Zuckerberg. He thought that the reason that Facebook stories weren't working out was because Instagram was able to go first. And around the time that Instagram stories was taking off and Facebook stories was not, Zuckerberg was concerned about a lot of things happening. People were not posting as much original content. They were posting links, they were posting videos, they were posting about the news, but they weren't as often posting their feelings, their thoughts, glimpses inside their lives. And meanwhile, Facebook was under fire for a lot of its involvement in the misinformation that spread ahead of the 2016 presidential election, for violent live videos, for all manner of things that regulators were upset about, that the public was upset about. And Zuckerberg thought, well, maybe those aren't the reason that people aren't posting as much original content on Facebook. Maybe the reason is that they've got somewhere else to post it. And maybe Instagram is actually a threat to Facebook's longevity.
So, is that when Facebook stopped linking users to Instagram?
Well, first they did a study to figure out if, because everything has to be related to the data at Facebook, they did a study to figure it out. And everyone read the data differently. So Kevin Systrom thought that the data showed that Instagram was increasing the overall share of Facebook Inc.'s influence in the world. Zuckerberg thought about it in terms of Instagram cannibalizing Facebook's potential, and he would use that word. And he did order the links from Facebook to Instagram cut off. So it used to be that if somebody posted an Instagram photo on Facebook, it would say it came from Instagram. It no longer does. And all of the navigation links, like if you see in your Facebook where it says you can go to events or you can go to Facebook Messenger, or you can go to all these different places, there's no longer a link to Instagram. And Instagram was asked to create more links to Facebook.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. With all this talk, that comes and goes in Congress and other places about breaking up a company as big as Facebook, does it seem like Instagram would be ripe for a spin-off? Do you think Facebook would want to get rid of the company?
It gets less ripe every day because one of the main things that Zuckerberg wanted to do in trying to get more control over Instagram is create a mega network of Facebook properties where it wasn't just about how big is Instagram, how big is Facebook, how big is WhatsApp, which they also own, by the way. It was how big is the overall quote unquote Facebook family. And what Zuckerberg has been doing right now, as they're under investigation for antitrust by the Federal Trade Commission, by the Department of Justice, by 47 state attorneys general, what Zuckerberg is doing is tying those products together behind the scenes so that they are all one, so that they share their data, they share their connections. And if regulators don't have time to, or don't finish, I mean, these antitrust investigations take years, in some cases, they take a decade. By the time they come up with some conclusion about what to do with Facebook's dominance, Facebook will have integrated them all even more tightly, making a breakup almost impossible.
What finally caused Systrom and Krieger to leave the company?
It was the sense that they were no longer the CEO and co-founder of Instagram. They were merely running a department of Facebook. And they thought that they were working for Facebook Inc. And they started to feel like they were working for Facebook, the social network. And their resources were restricted. They had trouble hiring specifically for Instagram. They had trouble building things that they wanted to build. And that was a really frustrating position for them to be in. But they just disagreed ultimately with Zuckerberg's vision to tie these products together and to make it so that there was less of a distinction between what an Instagram thing was and what a Facebook thing was.
How is Instagram doing without its founders there to protect their vision of it?
Well, it's becoming a lot more like Facebook. The notifications and recommendation engines and all those things that they used to turn up their nose at are certainly a part of Instagram now. We're seeing a lot more prompts from Facebook, from Instagram to go over to Facebook. We're seeing a lot more of you know, Facebook feeding on that Instagram advertising revenue. Instagram now contributes, if you ask how it's doing from a business standpoint, Instagram now contributes about a quarter of Facebook's revenue, about $20 billion, according to my sources, in 2019. So it's hugely important to the future of Facebook, but it's becoming more a part of it. In fact, Facebook now puts its own branding on Instagram. It says Instagram from Facebook when you download the app.
Any sense of what's in store for Instagram, what its future looks like?
Well, everything's being changed right now with the coronavirus. The thing that's most interesting about Instagram today is that all of the things we talked about with people presenting their life as more polished and beautiful than it actually is, and using it as a place for personal branding, well, with so many people suffering globally, it's very hard to justify posting those kinds of things on Instagram right now. And instead, what we've seen is people turned to live video. What used to be one of the most annoying things you could do on Instagram has now become one of the key products for people to see what, you know, live concerts, live tutorials on how to do such and such with your workout or with your cooking or with art. The amount of live content is really accelerating. So is the messaging on Instagram. Messaging is way up too, as people try to use this as a moment to actually connect with one another.
Journalist Sarah Fryer covers social media companies for Bloomberg News and is author of the new book, No Filter, The Inside Story of Instagram. Sarah, thanks so much for spending this hour with us.
Thanks for having me.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter. Our handle is at K-E-R-A Think, and we hope that you will subscribe to our podcast at whatever app you get your podcast. Just do a search for K-E-R-A Think. You can listen to our podcast on the website as well, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.